You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be looking at the classic 1960s British cult TV series UFO with another exciting episode with those intrepid folks at Shadow, the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization. And tonight's episode is Close Up. Well, first reactions. What'd you think of this episode?
Disappointing.
Disappointing.
Disappointing. It didn't quite measure up to past UFO episodes.
And some people could say that's measuring pretty far below the bar, but yeah, all right.
Yeah, like Simon?
It could be.
Well, and if their bar is that low, then yes, it does. It dips below, I think, anybody who has a standard bar where this series sits, this episode dips below it.
Really? I don't mind this episode.
I know why you don't mind this episode.
No, that's why I like the episode. But then, but I don't. I have some things about this episode that I am fascinated is not quite the right word for, but
intrigued.
I find this episode interesting, and I guess that's the best word for it. So let's just launch into it. The episode Close Up is. We've talked before a little bit about how UFO would sometimes try to break out of the mold of a standard action melodrama. And I think that's what they were trying to do in this episode, because this episode is not exactly bureaucracy in action, but it's the mundane day-to-day workings of Shadow. Without really the benefit of a story, strung along the plot device of a particular project that they're trying to implement, a research project, if you will. And that's why I find this episode interesting, because I can't think of any other show that had the guts to actually have a budget hearing and, you know, go through the process of having to get the money and things like that. So that's why this episode kind of interests me, because it shows how Shadow operates and how the politics and whatnot goes on. But from a standpoint,
in that respect, I would agree. I always find those kinds of episodes interesting, but there are other areas where this episode really falls flat on. And unfortunately, those were so glaring for me. You know, maybe not necessarily for anybody else, but for me, they were so huge that it became substandard.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's work our way through it here. And I've already warned Ben, but I'll warn our audience. I didn't take any notes. I have seen this episode enough times in the past that I felt that I could remember it through. That was 2 days ago. Today, I'm not 100% sure. But it starts off with it starts off with Straker and Foster, not Foster, the other
Freeman.
Guy. Freeman. At a satellite tracking facility, receiving some top secret data. Well, we learn it's top secret data from obviously from some camera in Earth orbit. And the first of the interesting lines to me was when they're driving away from this base and Freeman is talking about the guy who was helping them collect the data and how he said he really wants to see those pictures. Straker's response is, I hate to have to throw around the security word with somebody who's going out of their way to help us.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, kind of sets the tone of this episode, is that they're going to be talking about the things they have to do just to get the job done in the context of the world they live in.
And this episode became just nothing more than one enormous procedural.
Yeah, it's a procedural from one end to the other. I know one of the glaring flaws, but we'll see if I'm on the same target. They take this tape back, put it on their computer, and start printing out some incredibly generic looking satellite photos.
That was one of them.
Yep. And And what they do is they all just kind of drool.
They ooh and ah over these
look
photos.
At the tail. This looks like a helicopter shot while they're holding a picture which shows fully one third to a half of the entire Earth in it. So, yeah, that looks like a helicopter shot to me. Not. And, I know satellite technology was in its infancy and back then and so, but...
Yeah, but even then, it looked at least as good as that. And here we are, we're expected to accept that this is 1980, so we would like to see something that, if you're gonna peddle this, then it needs to be a little bit more fantastic.
And they had to be holding those pictures a little bit better, because some of them were close-ups of things, and then other ones were obviously way in, way, way out. And they would, if you were reading the inscriptions on them, there would be one that would say, there would be a picture of most of the Earth, and it would say 490 miles out, 100 times zoom. And then they'd have a picture of almost exactly the same perspective, and it would say 495 miles out, 2,000 times zoom.
Yeah.
But it's the same picture.
It's the same shot. I
yeah.
know.
And that was kind of bad. And of course, you know, we're looking back on it where you can fire up Google Earth and look at satellite photography that shows the tracks in the muck at the bottom of my pool where the pool cleaner is, you know, desperately trying to suck it up and died down at the bottom of the pool. So, you know, it's not going to impress a modern audience.
Not by any stretch, but even back then... I would have seen that and thought, but this doesn't look any better than anything that I've seen in my astronomy textbooks.
Right. So our next phase is that Straker goes off and he talks with a team working on the camera. And one of the two scientists on the camera, you know, asks to talk to Straker on the QT. And he says, you know, you're going to go, we get those budget hearings tomorrow and you're going to ask for that $1 billion for this project. And there are 53 items on that budget committee list. Yours is number one. Mine is number 52. I only need $50,000 to create my stereoscope, which they never tell us what that is. A stereo scan or something like that.
Stereo scanner, although they kind of hint at it at the end, but let's not jump ahead.
At the end, but not at this point in the story.
No.
In fact, at some point, the only thing we learn about it is that it's not about space.
And that was the thing that just really began to perplex me. So I thought, okay, this is Shadow. Everything that they're doing is about outer space,
yeah.
And this project certainly doesn't seem to reflect that.
Yeah, and you know, he asked Straker for his support, and Straker's like, no, I'm not going to, you know, I can't help you there. It's not a space project. And
I wish I could, but sorry.
I'm not going to. And then, you know, and I think you should turn your attention to space, because that's where the bucks are, guy. And then the guy, you know, kind of nicely says to Straker, he says, well, I hope you get your $1 billion. And Straker goes, I will get my $1 billion. It's a space project.
Talk about rubbing nose in it.
Not only does it talk about rubbing nose in it, it's rubbing my nose in it right now. It's
yeah.
Like, NASA, can you imagine if they had $1 billion?
Oh, no.
Instead, what do they get? Like about $200,000 a year plus salary or something nowadays? It's pathetic. And, you know, this is this major $1 billion project. So Straker goes to the International Astrophysical Commission for his budget hearing. And, of course, he's automatically on adversarial terms with General Henderson, who's like, you know, don't try to bulldog through your way through this one, Straker. We're going to get your money in. You know, really being nasty to him about it.
Well, that was as harsh as it got.
Well, no, it was a little harsher there when he started up at the beginning. And he says, we've got 53 items on the agenda here. And you all know Commander Straker. And by the look of the price tag on this number one, you all know which one he's here for. So, I mean, it's becoming clear to me that the reason that Henderson and Straker don't get along is money.
It's all about money.
It's money.
Yeah, but given past episodes where we've really seen them just go tooth and claw at each other, this one actually seemed kind of mild.
But yes, it does. But what it does do is it adds context to some of those earlier comments that he made about Straker being sort of irresponsible or extravagant. It you know, the way he runs Shadow and stuff, and it comes down now. It's like, you know, it's about hard bucks.
Henderson will be right on some of that, given some of the things that happened in this episode. But I don't wish to jump ahead.
Right. Okay. Well, and not saying that Henderson's wrong, just that. You know,
but it does kind of give
of the,
yeah, it gives you a sense of the animosity that exists between the two.
The project is the ability to take a modified Class 1 space probe, put a super powerful camera in it, organize a UFO to obligingly allow this thing to sort of lock onto it with a homing signal, and follow it back to the alien planet where we're going to get some pictures of their world.
Sounds great.
I'm not sure what it's good for. You know, in retrospect, it's like, well, we got some pictures of a planet. Well, we knew they came from a planet. Oh, this is what they live in. Well, we knew they probably lived in... You know, I don't know what they were hoping to get.
It doesn't change any facts.
Yeah, I don't know what they were hoping to get in terms of intelligence to fight against the aliens. But, you know, it's a space project, so it's okay. And I like space projects, and it would be the opportunity to go to the only known inhabited world apart from Earth. So it also gets into these little details, and we could argue that these details are there to make it realistic, or we could argue that these details are there to make the episode pad out to an hour. Like, they can't launch the satellite probe themselves. It's too big. So they've got to farm that off to NASA, but they can't put the camera on the shuttle or on the probe.
For security reasons.
Because it's on the secrets list, and apparently you can't put something on the secrets list with your best ally launching your space probe. So they have to go to moon base and fit it in lunar orbit into the camera, which, you know, takes some time and doesn't really accomplish much. But we kind of get to see the operation of Shadow and the kinds of organizations they are, and methodical, and how the process goes through.
Okay, so let me hit complaint number one.
Complaint number one.
Oh, that was very good.
I could have done that in post-production too.
Yeah, you could have. Okay, the whole idea of them having to launch this probe and then retrofit it with this special camera, which, by the way, let's be clear on the camera. It's an electron camera. I thought this was fascinating because as what Straker says during the budget meeting, he says, you know, the regular camera or regular telescope, it operates by receiving light. And he says, this is an electron telescope which operates with a stream of electrons. So my question immediately becomes, how can electrons alone be used to deliver a high-resolution picture? Now, maybe you can, and I just don't know the science. But this was kind of a new thing to me.
I was of the impression, and obviously we don't have the electron camera. They're probably basing this on an electron scanning microscope. And the reason we use, if I recall correctly, the reason we use electron scanning microscopes is because the size of an electron is smaller and allows a finer detail with atomic level, molecular level subjects. So it's acting kind of like you're beaming electrons against it, and then you're collecting the reflected.
Okay, so electrons. That was going to be my next question. I wasn't sure. That's one of the things I put in my notes. Does it actually transmit a stream of electrons to its intended subject, and then reinterprets them into some kind of an image? Sort of like what sonar might do, or as you just said, an electron telescope. Okay, so there we go.
I don't know that it would need to, because I think we have a constant stream of electrons coming out of like the solar wind and whatnot. So you could be just looking, just like you're looking at the infrared spectrum of light, you would be looking at scatter for maybe. You know, they're making it up, and I'm making it up too, just to try to justify. But you know, it could just be electron scatter coming off the object, just as we would be getting light scatter off of it if it were in the visible spectrum. So maybe.
Okay. Well, then. So that was actually one. So, but really, actually, I had a second one, and that was the idea of this satellite. They already had one in orbit.
Around Earth, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the camera.
Yeah, and even if that camera was a test model, why not just grab that one instead of launching a second one? And who knows how much money that would might have saved them. And then just put the bloody electron telescope in the old probe.
It's a good question. It's a good question, a fair question, one that is never answered.
And he said, "Yeah, why place a second probe in moon orbit? I mean, Shadow can just take, you know, they've got the necessary equipment, retrieve the probe to modify or enhance whatever equipment is there, and just put the dumb thing back in a parking orbit around the moon. It would save money, and it would have made Henderson very happy."
Okay, it's possible, however, that this modified Type 1 probe had different engines in it than one that they just put in orbit around Earth.
That would be complaint number two. Or complaint number – well, that's a complaint later on. I've got a list of complaints.
Yeah, you got a list of complaints. And,
yeah,
and
at some point
one
that
too.
One does come up. So, all right. Let's just put a pin in that one right now.
Put a pin in that one. Let's see. I don't think – there's nothing else that happens on the base except we do know that they've been maintaining radio blackout about this project. It's so top secret. So when Straker, Foster, and Ford –
Matheson?
Yes. Matheson, I think it is.
Who's like one of the head engineers for the telescope.
Go up to the moon. Nobody up there knows what's happening until they get there and give them the briefing. It's that top secret. However, Lieutenant Ellis, ever efficient, knows basics of what's going on. And she's anticipated, you know, duty rosters and flight schedules and things like that, and has them absolutely ready for Straker when he arrives at the moon base.
And it's not good enough.
Yeah, I wondered what that was about. Now, this is one of the ones that got me. So she hands him, is like, oh, here's a draft of the flight schedule.
It's a rough draft.
Rough draft of the flight schedule. And he looks at it and goes, well, it's very good, Gay. And because her name's Gay Ellis.
Yeah.
That's very good, Gay.
We'll have to go over this together.
Of course, we'll have to go over this together. And then her face goes all like, oh.
Well, I did say it was a rough draft.
So my question is it because he knows she doesn't know enough about the project that, you know, it's his baby. He's not going to let this go without checking it. Or is it because he's mashing on her?
I think, A, he's mashing on her, and B, he's a jerk.
But, you know, you can tell it registers when she...
But she walks
crestfallen.
Away. Yeah.
It registers on Straker.
He's like,
he knows I
was a bit hard.
Yeah. He knows he's not completely insensitive. As we've mentioned before, Straker is a hard man, but there is a human under there. It's just really
very,
suppressed.
Very deep.
It's very suppressed.
Yes.
And we also happen to see Sergeant Benton was one
yes,
of the...
Yes, John Levine was... He's one of the interceptor pilots.
In this episode. I think he even gets a line of dialogue. I think
he does
he's the
get
one
a
that
line.
Throws the camera out.
Camera, if he's the one who throws a camera, but he does get a line when the interceptors are all out flying,
right.
Trying to maneuver the UFO into position.
Yeah, that there too, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they go out and they do their thing, and they put the camera in, and it all goes perfectly to schedule. And they're at one point... Straker catches Lieutenant Ellis and offers to buy her a cup of coffee. And they're sitting alone in the coffee room in the astronaut's lounge or whatever it is. And, you know, he's telling her, you know, you do a great job up here. Yeah, you do a man's job. You do it really well. But, you know, sometimes you don't have to work extra hard just to prove that you can make it in the man's job. You know, you're just doing too much. And, you know, you have to remember,
you're a beautiful woman.
You're a beautiful woman. Which is the moment Foster is walking in the door.
Yeah, Foster walks right into that moment. And that was awkward.
And Lieutenant Ellis says, well, thank you, Commander. And
thank you for the coffee. And she walks out.
And she walks out. Then Straker walks out. And totally unbidden, without any, you know, again, this is all, what is going on there? As he walks past Foster, he stops. His little unsolicited advice for you, Colonel.
Never judge a conversation. By the end of a conversation.
Yeah, and walks out. It's like, again, was he mashing on her? Or was he trying to...
In a very chauvinistic way, build her up.
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is yes.
I couldn't tell. I mean, you know, in that purple hair, she's not, I don't know, she looks goofy. They all look goofy in that purple hair. Anyway, they also, and Lieutenant Ellis also facilitated their coordinated attack strategy. So UFO comes flying out at 8.2 times the speed of light.
8.35.
Well, they got up to 8.35, but it started at 8.2. But yeah, all right, fine. And then they fire some missiles, and they get it to swing around the moon and go back to its home planet, which they then reveal to us is a four-month journey, which tells me so that the UFO came out 4 months to be turned away and fly back four months. And not just is that stupid, but it makes their whole attack plan goofier than hell.
Exactly.
I mean, everything from every episode of the show, these guys fly 4 months out to land here, grab a body, and fly 4 months back.
And then, but here they are, they're flying 4 months out only to be turned away. I mean, history shows if we're going to take every single UFO incident that has happened and has been depicted in the series, then we must assume that either a UFO has successfully penetrated moon-based defense and has landed, or has been destroyed. So this whole bit about it being turned away, boy, if I were one of the UFO pilots, I would be highly suspicious as to what's going on.
Not only would I be highly suspicious, but I would think that I would be checking my rearview mirror on the way back.
A lot.
Yeah, but they apparently didn't.
Now this this brings up another complaint. We've actually jumped ahead.
Okay, which one is this? Is this number three?
This will actually be number four. We skipped number three, but we'll come back to it.
Okay, four. That doesn't work. Three is like the BBC Three sound logo bit, but I don't think they do it for BBC Four. Anyway.
Probably not. And that is the idea that this probe is supposed to, once it gets in close proximity to the UFO, that it would, quote unquote, attach itself and then just kind of follow. Well, that's all fine and good, but except, I'm not exactly aware that Earth has managed to come up with some kind of hyperlight travel.
Drive. Yeah, in fact, I think it's interesting. You get the cool UFO with the noise and the flying along at its hyperlight speeds, and then you have that probe with a little jet of flame coming out the back.
Yeah, and if I may have a nerd moment, we hear, was it Sid?
Yes.
Reports that the UFO is traveling at Sol minus 8.35. Now, what? Minus?
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I did. I played it back three times to make sure that I wasn't hearing things. So, of course, two things came to mind. Is it traveling backwards? Or is it decelerating? I mean, but if it had been at 8.25, then clearly it's not decelerating. It's accelerating. And then if that's the case, if it's traveling at 8.35, then that means it's traveling at 1,555,454.7 miles per hour. And at one moment, Sid says that it's 18 million miles away. And in the course of 7 seconds, it is now 17 million miles away. So it took 7 seconds for it to travel 1 million miles. I'm sorry, the math doesn't add up.
How fast is that? Did you work that one out?
I did, but I didn't write that one down. Shame on me, but I did work it out.
Yeah. Well, you know,
but it's going
time and distance doesn't work very well in TV movies.
No, but it's actually going slower. If it took 7 seconds for it to travel 1 million miles, and it's certainly not going 8.35 times the speed of light. So I know nitpicky. I accept that, but it was just one of those things. You know, every time I hear them start throwing out the Saul references, I have to do the math because it just bugs the crap out of me.
So what was number three then?
Number three, it's actually earlier when Stryker is having a meeting. It's a staff meeting with just the purple-haired ladies.
Yes, okay.
And there's this board that has an image of the moon on it, and then it has these two trajectories. They said the computer has figured out that these are the two main trajectories that UFOs approach. And I stopped and looked at it, and these two lines are at 90 degrees from each other, pretty much. Assume that the UFO is traveling, you know, at an extremely – I mean, it has to. I mean, no matter, we don't know how many million miles away, billion miles away. I mean, we just don't know how far away their home planet is. But it's taking them 4 months to make the trek over to the moon and Earth orbit. Odds are they're traveling in a straight line. And unless the window of opportunity changes so that you have these two very distinct angles from each other, the odds of the UFO coming in at such, you know, bizarre angles in relation to each other is really highly remote.
I could imagine that.
Unless it's doing a really bizarre detour at the last second.
It might be something that the UFO does to try to minimize its detection. So, you know, like the time they flew in at the sunrise coming across the moon during a high solar activity period, they're clearly aware that the moon base is there. And so there might be something that they just didn't tell us that says this is, you know, maybe coming in with the sun behind them at high noon on Thursdays when it's a full moon over North America or whatever it happens to be. But, you know, and then, of course, the trajectories coming in, if they're measuring it against the moon, doesn't make any sense either because their destination is the Earth.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe they come in at two different times a month.
Well, that's what I was saying, two different windows of opportunity. And I thought, well, that would be really funny if they came in, you know, two different times of the month. And I thought, wow, you could actually clock that.
Of course.
And maybe they do.
Of course, you know, since Shadow's been in operation, they haven't really improved their strategy for flying ships in. They just send some in once in a while to see if they get through. And so that's either smacks of extreme desperation or just they're not very bright.
Well, going back to the first episode, Stryker hypothesizes that they are a dying civilization. Maybe they just don't have the brightest pilots flying those things.
Could be. Okay, so the probe.
Oh, the probe. The
probe follows the aliens back to their planet.
Yeah, a 4 month journey at sublight speed.
Assuming the probe was going sublight.
It wouldn't take 4 months for it to get home. Unless the planet was in our solar system.
Of course, if it was.
Which the end credits always seem to suggest.
I guess you could look at it that way. I just thought they were sort of indicative of, well, a space scene.
You know? Yeah, but the way they play that closing music in the closing credits, it always feels like that when you get when the camera pulls back and it kind of pulls back next to this one planet and you see the Earth and the moon off in the distance and there's this very dramatic bomb 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 kind of music and you get the feeling must be home.
Hmm.
I've always gotten that feeling. Hmm. So
I always got the War of the Worlds feel that once they've pulled back far enough that we're kind of looking at our solar system, that distant eyes, cool and unemotional stare at us, or, you know, from the opening world kind of thing. But
well, I would accept that. I would like that because I can't stand the idea that the UFOs are actually coming from a planet within our own solar system. I mean, it just kind of does away with the whole thing about, well, why are they traveling at, you know, eight times the speed of light on what would technically be a very, very short jaunt. I mean, by the time they got up to that kind of speed, they'd zoom right by us.
They should really build bigger starships and bring in a carrier and bring it up nearby or something. And then we could probably fix their tactics if they were willing to pay us.
Yeah, I'm sure we could.
Well,
So the point is, in terms of this episode, is the UFO has returned to its home planet, never looking in the rearview mirror. Very good. Took 4 months for it to get home. We must assume if it's traveling at super light speeds that it's a planet that's way the heck far away from us, and yet this probe was able to follow.
It's because of the electron scope or something. I don't know.
You know better than that.
Yeah, all right. I know better than them.
It's BS.
Yeah.
It's now 4 months later.
It's now 4 months later, and the first of the pictures come back. And then,
right, as the bloody probe is taking the photos, too.
Well, yeah, because the subspace communications network.
Oh, so Shadow has a subspace communication network. Oh, okay.
Well, that could only mean that it's only 2 months away at the speed of light, and it's 2 months for the signals to come back. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it's bad science because see the cameras taking photos right there and then, and they're getting the images virtually instantly.
So we've got these pictures, and they are amazing. Look at the detail.
But, and here's yet another problem. What you were seeing on those photos was not the planet that the probe was orbiting. Because there's a scene, and I played this one back several times.
Yeah, the planet it's orbiting looks a lot like
moon.
Yeah.
It's very moon-like, and yet the planet that you see in the photos looks rather Earth-like.
Hmm. That's amazing. Well, it's all, you know, that just depends on your perspective at the time and your magnification.
And your magnification and your distance.
So here is the thing that you know, the whole thing is we've gone through this entire episode. We've gone through the budget and the politics and the atrophying and the
personnel issues.
Personnel issues and the whole nine yards. And we've got these pictures, which we've got no clear idea what these pictures are going to do for us to start with. But okay, you know, I'm all for it. If we knew there was another planet out there, I would just for the sake of it, I'd want to get pictures of it that had life on it. So I'm cool with that. But the metadata doesn't come back with it. Whereas the first pictures from the Earth print up, and they actually have a nice little thing printed at the bottom that says, you know, range 495 miles. Magnification 2000. At the end, that bottom section is blanked out. And so these pictures are
worthless.
Completely worthless. They're totally useless. You can't use them for anything, nothing. And Straker then goes back to our friendly guy who was in the earlier part of the episode talking about
his name is Lieutenant Kelly, I believe.
It's Mr. Stereo Scan guy.
Yeah.
Mr. I want my $50,000. And he explains to Straker, without that information, they could be looking at a microbe, or they could be looking at a piece of pollen. You don't know what you're looking for. You can't disjudge anything. And he demonstrates it by showing
a close-up of Alice's legs.
This is, you know, we've seen her before outside the moon base once or twice, like that time she was having the affair with a black astronaut in one of the earlier episodes. They don't wear the purple. But I don't know what they did in her on this particular episode.
That was bad hair.
She is stunning. I mean, just the rest of the episode just kind of goes away, and you just look at that and go, that is just one objectified but staggeringly beautiful woman sitting there with her leg up, having it photographed practically up her skirt so that they can get the... It's a model pose. I mean, she's not even, you know, just like hanging around the lab. She's like in leg up, and it's very impressive, though. It's very, very impressive. It makes this episode.
And probably the only reason why Straker went along with the whole idea of the stereo scan. Okay, well, he used Ellis, and I got my jollies, so okay.
Yeah,
you get your money.
He does actually go back and scan in on her again. Hold on a second. And then he goes back and he does zoom in again.
It was so terrible.
It was terrible. It would have been – I mean, he didn't zoom in on her breasts or anything. He didn't move the camera around. If it had been James Bond, he would have zoomed in on her breasts a lot. I think it was Octopussy or whichever film they did that in. But, again, it's just like, is Straker mashing on her? Because, you know, in this particular instance, you couldn't blame him. It's just weird. I mean, why would he pick her? Why would he pick her as a subject to be standing there to be used as a guinea pig for taking extreme? Unless that's what he was doing. I mean, that's what Kelly or whatever his name was doing before Straker walked in.
Well,
he was doing a stereo scan of her.
We do know that before Straker leaves Moonbase, he does invite her to come to Shadow Control next time she's back on Earth. So she's having a furlough. She's gone back to Earth, and I'm sure that Kelly says, "Oh, you know what? You're perfect for my needs."
Okay, there's another. There's an. Oh, he said leeringly.
Yes.
There's another thing. I mean, one, Straker apparently doesn't know she's there.
No.
So Straker said, "Come visit me when you're on furlough," and she didn't. That's one.
Well, she may have been, pardon the pun, intercepted before she had a chance to make her presence known to Straker.
I could be persuaded, although I can't be persuaded just as a red-blooded male. I couldn't be persuaded. It's one or the other. You don't know what I'm talking about, but the fact is, you could take it as being that she was there because of Kelly. In other words, she came to Earth for furlough, and she went to visit him. Now, why is she hanging out with him? Is that a sexual thing? And the reason I say yes is that's the way it's set up. And the reason I say no is because, come on, that guy's just too old and craggy for her. I mean, you know, he'd be punching way out of his league.
Oh, and that has stopped people like Freeman.
That hasn't even stopped people like me, to be fair. But I could picture her down there with, say, Matheson. Closer to her age kind of thing. But Kelly just kind of seems like an old... Yeah, anyway. But I kind of got that out of it. It's like, you know, she's hanging out with him for some reason. And that's... Anyway, so he gives Straker an example of, you know, here's some pollen, here's some this, and here's some that. And it's amazing stuff. And, you know, and Straker starts philosophizing about how there's whole worlds inside these little tiny spaces just waiting for discovery. And as he gives this long speech about this amazing undiscovered country that they haven't gone to, the camera turns around and he's in Henderson's office, and he's actually pitching that stereo scan to Henderson, and Henderson, "Oh, you'll have your $50,000, Straker." And I'm like, okay, you've just pitched eloquently, but honestly, the defense implications of being able to look at things that are really small are really small. In fact, they're non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And Straker sounds like he's having this revelation of understanding and wonder.
It's more like a philosophical revelation than one of a scientific.
Okay, there's a whole nature. World down there. There's a whole town of Whoville on one of those things somewhere. But they don't matter in the defense of the Earth against the aliens, you know?
Yeah.
And why would it matter to the International Astrophysical?
Well, this comes back to the whole thing. What was the purpose of Kelly's project anyway?
I don't know.
And why is he attached to Shadow with a project like that? When, I mean, okay, he kind of gives this thing about how if you had some kind of a stereoscopic image, you could then figure out what your distance was and what your magnification was. But without a stereo scan, you've got no way of knowing.
But I didn't get that from it. Now, the only reason I got...
I kind of did.
Well, again, they didn't call it the stereo scan at the end of the episode, as I recall.
No, but he did make reference to some sort of stereoscopic reading. He did say something along those lines, which kind of told me that he was pimping out his project again, saying, "See, if you went with my project instead of yours, then we could have had mine all set up, and we would have been able to help you on yours and give you all the information you wanted. So, neener, neener, boo, boo."
I think I can answer your question as to why he was on that project, though. Matheson said so. When the project was closing down for the ship, he said, "You know, I've learned so much working with you." So obviously Kelly is just a top-notch technician. That's all.
Mm.
And he's obviously an expert on optics or something of that nature, and that was the project he was assigned on. But his pet project, it's kind of like those guys at Google that, you know, are given a little bit of time on once a week to work on their own projects.
And their own pet project, which is not job-related.
Yeah, yeah. I think that might be what they're going at. So in which case, Shadow is a very progressive organization. Totally.
Well, with hair and costumes like that, I would only hope so.
And I think that's it. I mean, you know, there was like very little, a couple of explosions, and just really for show. And that was it.
Well, for me, as I said, I usually like the episodes. Some I like more than others, but generally I've liked pretty much all the UFO episodes I've seen. Not this one. I kind of, for me, the science was very poor. And sometimes bad science can really pull me out of a story. Even though this was more of a procedural than it was of a hard science fiction kind of story, the science was so badly presented that I could not get past it. And at that point, everything else in this story just began to fall flat.
And I'm thoroughly not convinced that by not having the range and magnification numbers that the data is useless.
And yeah, it was the other thing.
I'm not convinced. Really? I mean, I'm not convinced that it's useful to begin with.
No, but it's not worthless.
It's like, you might as well just tear these pictures up and burn them then. I mean, with the first pictures of an alien planet... nothing. We'll just tear them up.
Because we don't know how close we are. We don't know what kind of magnification we have. So we have no idea what it is we're looking
I'm
at.
I'm thinking if you saw like a big field and it had a bunch of the UFOs sitting on it, you could probably go, hey, that's probably their landing pad. And then you could go, well, we know how big the UFO is. Oh, wait a second. I think we've got something to work with here.
Yeah, just kind of play with the image. Pull back. Move forward. You know, blow it up. Get and if you start to come...
Keep saying enhance until the picture is clear.
Exactly. I mean, just don't dismiss it as being useless at this point. I mean, that was rather irresponsible, I thought.
Yeah. That was that part. And we totally forgot to mention Skydiver.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they went through everything. They went through everything in this episode, you know, the skydiver, the moon base, the shuttles, the takeoff to the shuttles, the orbital watches, the probes, the interceptors, everything.
The Land Rovers or whatever those things are.
They didn't have the mobiles.
We didn't have the mobiles, but that was it. Aside from that, we had everything else.
But Skydiver was doing a completely pointless bit of activity out at the sea. They had to come up. They had to get a satellite shot to find out some information.
Looked cool.
And then a ship appeared on the horizon. They had to do a crash dive. So, again, you're giving us a little bit of the way Shadow operates. We have to be completely secret. Ships can't see us. But we've got this fleet out there. And yet it really didn't advance the story. It was just killing.
It was padding, but it was beautiful padding. It looked great. I've always been sort of turned on by Skydiver. I've always thought that was just the coolest looking sub.
It'd make a great looking spaceship.
I bloody wish they had made a model of it for me to own.
Maybe someday they will. You know, retro design.
Well, just release a whole line of UFO model kits.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a model for the Interceptor, a model for the Skydiver that has the detachable. Flying cockpit, model UFO, model moon base, model car. I mean, there's a good little line right there.
Really, there's a lot of marketing.
There's a good line of merchandise you can come up with right there. I'd get them.
And I'm sure all the kids today watching UFO will be right in line to buy it too. Oh yeah, there's the problem. There is the problem.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, I think that one just about beats this episode of UFO over the head and deposits it without magnification or distance information into the dustbin of Fusion Patrol history.
Yeah.
So thanks for joining me again, Ben.
My pleasure.
And we hope you'll all join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
Been listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.